Good evening and welcome to this edition of the Paranet Continuum, home of common sense, no-nonsense talk radio. Now tonight we're going to have a very interesting set of guests on the program. The question tonight we're going to ask is, what do extraterrestrial contact, military intelligence, and the mysteries of ancient Egypt have in common? Well, some might say nothing, but my guests have unraveled a very, very interesting connection between the three. They have published a book, first available in the United Kingdom and now available in the United States. The book is called The Stargate Conspiracy, and the subtitle is just that, Revealing the Truth Behind Extraterrestrial Contact, Military Intelligence, and the Mysteries of Ancient Egypt. Now, my guests tonight are Lynn Picknett. She is a writer, TV presenter, and broadcaster. She was the deputy editor of the seminal 1980s publication The Unexplained and has appeared regularly on radio and television as a consultant on the paranormal. Her books include The Encyclopedia of the Paranormal, published in 1990. Clive Prince is a historical researcher specializing in religious mysteries, secret societies, and the occult. And it's a pleasure to welcome to the program tonight. Good evening, Lynn and Clive.
Good evening to you.
Hello.
Yes, and thank you for being with us on the program.
Not at all. It's our pleasure.
Now, let's start off real quick, because as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, and your subtitle says, what do extraterrestrial contact, military intelligence, and the mysteries of ancient Egypt have in common? Let's talk about what the thesis of this book is. What is the whole core of it?
Well, I think we have to be aware of where we started with this.
Okay.
This book is our story in a way. We'd just written a book tracing the origins of Christianity back to Egypt, and what we wanted to do with this book, with our next book, was to delve some more into the mysteries of ancient Egypt. And that was precisely what we wanted to do. We didn't want to do anything else. But when we started looking into Egypt, we inevitably discovered what was going on in Egypt now. And, that was about 1995-ish, 1996-ish.
Uh-huh.
And there was an awful lot of skullduggery going on there with rumors and counter-rumors of exciting things about to be found under the Sphinx or under the Great Pyramid. And we began to smell a rat. We thought there's actually something here that is myth-mongering quite deliberately.
Uh-huh.
And we began to delve into that. And that's where this book grew out of it.
Now, I must say, I detected the same amount of skullduggery and things going on as well. I was doing my radio program. It started in 1994. We had one of your countrymen over here at one point, Graham Hancock. I arranged to meet him, and we interviewed him a couple of times on the program. And I have to admit that I started smelling a very large rat as well. And this is one of the things I personally found so fascinating and interesting about your book is, you know, that you have really, you know, gone in there and connected the dots and answered a lot of questions I think a lot of people in the audience will have on this.
Well, I mean, it's we answered the questions as we went along. Because, as Lynn said, we started off, you know, we were very excited about a lot of these things that were happening in Egypt.
Uh-huh.
And, these connections being made not just with the ancient past, but with, you know, possible extraterrestrial visits and an influence on human civilization. And it was all very exciting. But when we actually really began to focus on it and look at things, we began to, the whole thing began to kind of crumble apart. And what we realized was that this whole belief system that was being pushed very, very heavily on the lead up to the millennium, but is still being pushed,
mm-hmm.
was really something that had been put together quite deliberately. And there was an agenda behind it.
Now, let me ask you this. When you say that there's a belief system being put forward, now, from reading the book, I gather that what's happening here is that they're taking, we'll identify they in a minute, but they are taking something that has ancient history, and they're retrofitting it with an agenda of their own. For what purpose?
The purpose is the ideas that are built into this manufactured belief system are very, very potent ones. Also, you know, quasi-religious
mm-hmm.
ideas.
And political.
And political. But essentially, that, you know, they're ideas that have the same potency as the great religious ideas. It's about, you know, it's about the pyramids, it's about Sphinx, exciting things like that. It's about, you know, possible higher civilizations, the ancient gods, if you like, that can come back and save the world for us. And whenever you get a belief system that powerful, or beliefs that are that powerful, and if you can mold them together, there, of course, there is a political side to that, a political aspect to that, because you can gather followers. It's simple as that, really.
Right.
And the idea that, I mean, no myths are more powerful than ancient Egypt. Everybody loves ancient Egypt. Everybody thinks that there's some, you know, great mystery there and some astonishing power. And a lot of writers that were doing very nicely, thank you, certainly in Britain, in the mid, the early and mid-1990s, were actually, as you said, pushing this idea that there is a connection between this sort of mysterious power that the Egyptians must have had and what's going to happen in the near future to us. And, of course, the people who held the key to that were the authors themselves and people they knew, and also some sort of shadowy figures. But it certainly wasn't the man in the street.
No, it was not, and I agree with you 100% on that. Now, let's do this. We've got about 2 minutes in the segment before we have to go to break, but Let me start off by asking you, when you guys were doing your research and you were getting into the thick of things, what was the first tip-off to you that caused you to pause and sit back and cock an eyebrow and say, there's something going on here?
I guess it had to be that when we first started asking questions, was that there was this magic date that kept coming up. 10,500 BC.
Yes, a very popular number.
Yeah, an ancient civilization, and that's the time the civilization disappeared. Now, this fitted into the prophecies or the psychic readings that were given by Edgar Cayce, who's probably a name that would be familiar to a lot of your listeners.
Yes.
And it was, very quickly, it's as we began to look at the evidence that was put forward to support the importance of that particular date, we realized that evidence was being sort of massaged pretty heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just the first question marks, it was over that date. And it kind of then moved on from there. At that point, we thought we better look at this a lot more critically than we have been.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of this thing started to kind of just sort of come apart in our hands as we looked at it.
Okay, so basically then, when you saw that there was something working on, the material that you were working with, and it was being massaged very heavily, what kind of tipped you off as far as who? We're going to get into the next segment. When we get into that, we'll talk about who the players are that you identified. But essentially, is this a very highly organized agenda, or is this something that a small group of people are operating by themselves?
I think there is a very focused agenda, and possibly more than one. There's certainly different groups of people involved in this, but they all come together to produce the effect on hearts and minds, which is the whole point.
Okay. All right. We're going to take our first break, and when we come back, we're going to unravel even more of this mystery, and we'll find out. They've identified, actually, it's very interesting. When you hear some of these names, you're going to be very surprised. But we're going to identify some of the players in this, and we're also going to find out where some of these plots go. My guests tonight are Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, and the book is The Stargate Conspiracy, and it is available in the United States now, is that correct?
Yes, that's right, yes.
On probably Amazon.com and in bookstores. Revealing the truth behind extraterrestrial contact, military intelligence, and the mysteries of ancient Egypt. And again, it's very much a pleasure to have you two on the program with us tonight to discuss this very interesting and very important, I think very important work, which helps to wake people up or get people savvy to what I consider to also be a very focused agenda with very dark undertones. Would you agree with that?
Yes, you would. I mean, that's exactly why we wrote the book, because we got very concerned about the way this whole thing seemed to be going. It seemed to be building up to... you can liken it to... We're all familiar with some of the kind of the New Age cults that have been around.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Heaven's Gate, things like the Solar Temple, where quite a what is to most people quite a fringe belief is actually used to take people over.
Mm-hmm.
Used to that on a small scale with these cults, but it seemed to us as if this was being built up to happen in a much larger scale, actually turn it into a mass movement. That's why we got concerned, and that's why we actually wrote the book. That's why we felt strongly enough to put these ideas out there.
And I have to say that when we were writing it, we kept looking at each other and thinking, no, this can't be true, but it is true. We've got this evidence for it. And we were, frankly, quite terrified on behalf of, you know, human race sometimes.
Uh-huh, because this is a very large conspiracy, is it not?
No, it is. And it's also very extremely cynical. But then, of course, one would expect a degree of cynicism behind something like this.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea that certain people know the great secrets of the ancients and then have the arrogance of saying, not only do we know the secrets of the ancients, but we know what's going to happen to the future. We're the only people who know what's going to happen to the future. You better stick with us.
That's it. Hmm. Now, let's turn our attention to Giza, because I know during your research, some strange things were happening over there in Giza. A lot of the people that were watching television were being treated to ideas that there was a fellow over in Egypt, Zahi Hawass, I believe his name was.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember interviewing, when I interviewed Graham Hancock, there was some controversy over some things that Hawass had been doing, you know, with the Egyptian government in the United States, with some of these people and some of the researchers that were going on over there. What did you find when you guys were studying the Giza mystery?
Well, what we found was a great deal of, as Lynn said earlier, myth-making. Because I think for most of the 1990s, there were all these rumors, sometimes a bit stronger than rumors, you know, stories going around of a discovery that had been made somewhere, you know, maybe underneath the Sphinx, maybe in the Great Pyramids. Many stories about, you know, something important has been discovered, but the authorities in Egypt are covering it up. But when we actually really got down here, we went over to Egypt ourselves, we had a look around the Giza Plateau, we talked to a lot of these researchers, and we found that from what we could see was happening was that these stories were being manufactured. These stories of hidden chambers containing, you know, wonderful secrets, wonderful knowledge. Every one of these, there was about half a dozen different locations on the Giza Plateau that was the focus of one of these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, we went in some ways actually kind of, you know, more than half believing them ourselves. But then as we looked at each one, it turned out to be, yes, you know, a tomb had been found, but it wasn't really that exciting.
Uh-huh.
And we realized this whole layer of mystery was being built around these things. And it almost seemed a weird sort of, don't really want to use the word conspiracy, word collusion, that's the word I'm looking for, between, for example, Graham Hancock and Zahi Hawass, who were kind of supposed to be the two opposite camps. Zahi Hawass was the, you know, the representative of the Orthodox Egyptology.
Mm-hmm.
Graham Hancock was the representative of the alternative industry.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they both seem to be sort of helping each other along here by creating, building up mystery about exactly the same things, and actually feeding and playing off each other. To take something that was, you know, either didn't exist at all or was a very mundane discovery,
right,
and
right,
turning it into this worldwide mystery.
Mm. Let's take.
And then there was the thing about the millennium, which was Robert Bovall, who's a colleague of Graham Hancock and a very successful writer on his own account.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to, on the stroke of midnight, oversee or present to the world on television at the Giza Plateau the dropping of a gold capstone onto the Great Pyramid, at the stroke of midnight. And then, we were all waiting for this, Robert Bovall was going to address the planet.
Oh!
I mean, we couldn't wait. But as it happened, Egyptian authorities didn't like the sound of this. Because, of course, in all of this, nobody really consults the Egyptians, you know.
Right.
Kind of, all us Westerners go and stomp all over Egypt, and nobody really consults them. But they didn't like it because it smacked too much of Freemasonry.
Uh-huh, yes.
And of course, Freemasonry is illegal in Egypt.
Is it really? I didn't know that.
Yes, it didn't.
Yes. Well, that's great.
The whole thing ground to a halt.
So there was no gold capstone set
up. No, and there was no message to the planet by Robert Bovarfer, which we all ought to be very grateful.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, it's interesting to look back too a little bit on the whole set of events that led up to the so-called the new millennium celebration that they were planning. But
yes.
If we could, we've got about a minute and a half. One of you tackle let's take one of the myths about the Sphinx and explain how that turned out to be a myth and where that originated from.
Well, there's been for a long, long time an idea that there was something important buried underneath the Sphinx.
Right.
It actually goes back to psychic, what we'd call today, channeled information by Edgar Cayce, who I mentioned earlier.
So Clive, is that where it actually originated, was Edgar Cayce?
This idea of the Hall of Records beneath the Sphinx that was Cayce's sort of psychic input, which came around about the 1920s.
Right. Okay.
Now there had been ideas. There've been ideas for centuries that somewhere around there, there's some kind of secret of the ancient Egyptians buried. Probably for centuries there's been various ideas, but the first kind of concrete thing of saying, well, yes, there is this repository of lost knowledge, and I know where it is through my psychic information, was with Edgar Cayce, who linked it with Atlantis. He said that's where, you know, the Sphinx and the pyramids were actually built by the survivors of Atlantis, and they put all their secrets into this chamber and built the Sphinx on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Really,
yeah.
Where this big push for the millennium kicked off was all this excitement about really focusing on the Sphinx.
Okay, so basically then, has that whole notion then been kind of disproven, that there's nothing there?
It's impossible to prove a negative that there's nothing there. So nobody's found it.
Okay.
There have been some echo soundings where they've found cavities around the Sphinx and underneath the Sphinx. But it's a limestone plateau. There are cavities in limestone anyway.
Right.
No one's actually got enough evidence to seriously want to dig into these cavities and find out what's in there.
Okay.
There are holes all over the plateau.
Yeah.
You just have to walk around it and practically, you know, break your neck every 5 minutes. I mean, it's just amazing.
Okay. We had a very interesting discussion about the Giza plateau and some of the things that were going on there. What I'd like to do is kind of move into the next area of interest, and that is, what is the fascination that a lot of people have, or the connection between Mars, the Mars face, and Egypt? And I know that a lot of these people that you've identified in the book as participating in whatever agenda this is, all have been pushing some of these ideas. How does that figure into this, the Mars mission?
Well, I mean, certainly Graham Hancock, who you mentioned, and other prime movers in this, I wouldn't go so far as to call it a conspiracy, but this movement, shall we say, like Richard Hoagland, the American science writer, who is quite a presence. The idea apparently stemmed sort of logically from the face of Mars,
right.
The NASA picture, original picture. Mm-hmm. And the thinking, to put it very simply, appears to be, among people who sort of hold this view, that, there's this face on Mars, it looks like a sphinx.
Right.
And there's a sphinx on Mars, and there's a sphinx in Egypt, and oh, there must be a connection.
Yeah, about it. But there certainly was this convergence of, people are probably familiar with the idea of the face on Mars and various other strange features of the Martian landscape, which, Lynn and I agree, they are strange, they're very interesting, appear to be pyramid-type structures. But gradually this began to converge with all these things we were talking about that were going on in Egypt. Graham Hancock, for example, went on to write a book called The Mars Mystery, which dealt with these, the face on Mars and the other so-called monuments of Mars. Richard Hoagland began with researching the face on Mars, but then began to point to connections with ancient Egypt. And we suddenly began to see this whole thing converging and coalescing into one large belief system. But with the face on Mars thing, that's equally full of holes, particularly when you get down to looking at the alleged connections between the Martian monuments and the ancient Egyptian monuments.
Right.
A lot of that is very faulty reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, recent pictures of the face show that it's nothing more than a rocky outcrop.
Right, exactly.
Mind you, Richard Hoagland, in a characteristic fashion, described those pictures as crap.
Yeah, it seems like they still are trying to keep that whole myth alive, you know, keep it going.
Yes, I mean, he's obviously furious by these, what you presumably seems as an attempt to undermine the theory,
mm-hmm.
rather than just an objective viewpoint or objective evidence of what it really is.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about some of the people now that you guys have discovered in this thing. And my first question is, what do they have to benefit from this? In other words, you mentioned that this could be, this could have serious implications for humanity on the planet. Let's talk about what it seems to be the object of this whole theater.
You could start, by saying, well, a lot of these mysteries are manufactured, so people can write books about them and make money. That's, where you'd seem to start, the most obvious thing. But gradually, as we looked at it more and more, we said it's more about getting this belief system. In which you're basically convincing people that some major event is just around the corner, just a few years away. Some, either great catastrophe is going to affect the world or some world-shaking event that is going to come in from outside. The gods are going to return, the aliens are going to come to save us, and that these particular people... And this isn't the authors that we've just been talking about. These are the people that are really, really behind the thing, pulling the strings. These are the ones that actually are, have a hotline to the aliens, have a hotline to the gods. So they will be our prophets, our representatives. It's really the old story of the cult leader writ large, or the prophet who wants to gather followers.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but also there's very disquieting thread underlying this, which is that the whole of this theory about the past, the gods coming down in the past to give us civilization, which was indeed an ancient Egyptian idea, and many other civilizations too. But, of course, we have these modern people seizing on that and saying, and the gods are going to come back and help us out again. And what, of course, the implication of that is that mankind is weak and feeble and can't do anything by itself.
Right.
You know, so you have to trust in outside agencies in order to sort things out.
Yes.
And the agents of those agencies, who just happen to be these guys, who are pushing the theory.
Sure. How far in your research, how far back have you guys gone as far as connecting the dots, and where does it all start? Where does it all start for you guys?
Well, there are several places where you could start the story, but the best one is around 50 years ago. So a lot of the ideas that have been used as part of this process are ideas that have been around for a long time. Edgar Cayce's prophecies and predictions, for example, made back in the 1920s and 30s. But it seems that somebody began to take them and start to put them together, almost like constructing a jigsaw puzzle,
mm-hmm.
To create a picture that looked good to people. It was a completely made-up picture, but it looked good. This has been a process. It started around sort of the early 50s, but really escalated as we got nearer and nearer the millennium.
Uh-huh.
It really kicked in at the mid to late 80s, I think.
Well, Cayce's foundation was fledgling at some point. I don't think it ever... I guess in its early history, I don't think it ever really did well till, what was it, 1970? What year was it that it started to really...
It was around 1968, 69.
Okay.
When it suddenly began, got quite an influx of money coming in from rich sponsors. Before, it basically just didn't have very much money.
Were you able to track some of those sponsors that got it kicked off in the early or late 60s?
Not really, no. It was interesting to us that it was all... the Casey thing started to kick off around the time when some interesting discoveries were made off the coast of Bimini in the Bahamas.
What was that?
These were some features that were found off the coast of the island, which looked artificial and could have been remnants of an older civilization. It happened to tie into a prediction that Casey had made that Atlantis would rise in 1968 or 69. So people saw these things and said, this looks like could be the remains of an ancient civilization, still not proven. That's Atlantis rising. And this seemed to sort of suddenly kick off a whole lot of people to want to give finance, want to give money. It's quite a hard one to trace because obviously they tend to keep that kind of information to themselves.
Yeah, I mean, what is interesting about Casey to me is that, when we really looked at his other prophecies, and he's got to be the worst prophet in the history of the universe.
That's what I've heard.
I mean, he didn't get a single prophecy right.
Mm-hmm.
For example, he said that in the 1960s, and he was prophesying in the 40s or whenever, he said in the 1960s, China would become Christian.
And it didn't happen, of course.
That's quite a big one.
Yeah.
He didn't actually prophesy the Second World War, which was some, little thing to miss, really.
So basically, what you had here was you had a group or an organization that could be retrofitted for whatever purpose that might serve as a springboard to start propagating all this stuff.
Yes, and the thing that fascinated me was, because you don't really read this in the the books that you buy about Casey's prophecies,
right.
But Casey was a very influential Freemason.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to be behind quite a lot of his prophecies about Egypt, and of course the gold capstone being put on the top of the Great Pyramid.
Right.
That's a Masonic prediction, if you like, a Masonic thing.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, Edgar Casey actually predicted, this was his thing about the Hall of Records, which, the ancient Atlanteans had placed under the Sphinx, was that he predicted that in 1998, that Hall of Records would be rediscovered.
Okay.
All the ancient knowledge of the Atlanteans in there. That discovery, which was supposed to have happened in 1998, was to trigger a new age, and a new age in particular in which the ideals of and principles of Freemasonry would become the dominant force in the government of the world.
Yeah.
Now, Casey made that prophecy a long, long time ago, but you can understand as it got nearer and nearer to 1998, there was a lot of, you can see there's an interest in a lot of people to think, well, let's make this prediction come true. It suits us that this prediction will come
let's
true.
Let's massage it,
find make
it. Find
the whole record in 1998.
Okay.
If we have to invent it.
Yeah. Returning from the United Kingdom are my guests, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. We're talking about the Stargate conspiracy. And before we went to break, we're talking about the Edgar Casey Foundation and the influx of money that came into it in the late 60s. Now, one thing I want to ask you. I've never seen many people mention this, but I noticed that in your book you mentioned a paper that was written called The Changing Image of Man. Can you tell us a little bit about that paper?
Yes, this was a report that was commissioned by the United States government in around about 1970, probably the late 60s, and was finally finished and written up in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And the background to this was what happened during the 1960s is that society had changed, particularly in America, particularly in the West, but the world had changed because of the hippie movement, all those social changes that had happened in America throughout the 60s. And the government actually wondered where this was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so they commissioned a research institute called SRI International to do this kind of social study and to conclude what all these changes meant for government.
Mm-hmm.
And what SRI concluded was that all these changes, greater awareness of environmental issues, the greater the self-awareness movement, all these things which obviously lessened the respect in the traditional institutions, as they would say, less respect for the government.
Uh-huh.
Comparing, say, the 1950s to the 1970s, things have changed dramatically. All these things were weakening respect for the institutions. The report actually concluded that these trends, these things, were unstoppable. They were going to get bigger, there was nothing that the government or the military or anyone could do about it. So what it looked at instead was strategies for, it's really, if we can't beat them, let's join them, or rather, let's take this over.
Mm-hmm.
Strategies for taking, I guess it's what we would call, the new age.
Mm-hmm.
They saw all this kind of movement towards the new age as being unstoppable. So they said, okay, let's try and think of ways that we can take it over, so that at least once these changes have happened, the same people at the top of the pile afterward as they were before.
Now, I know you mentioned earlier the Freemasonry thing has a big part to play in this. Isn't it possible that, some people in the United States believe that a lot of this social change that occurred in the 60s was actually hatched, in the 50s in the CIA here, under mind control in ways that they could change the... change the paradigm of people in preparation for, some kind of global or, rule, using mind control. Is it possible that the changing image of man was basically a blueprint for that?
I think almost certainly. And it's funny you should mention mind control, because certainly we uncovered very, very disturbing evidence that part of this attempt to hijack the new age involved some elements of mind control. Specifically, there's a parapsychologist called Dr. Andrei Puharich.
Very familiar with that name here in the United States, definitely.
Yes, mm-hmm. And basically, although he did believe in the paranormal, he was a total believer. I mean, he wasn't a sort of cynical, complete fabricator at all.
Yeah.
But he believed that he could. He investigated talents such as shamanism, such as channeling, and basically trained or even controlled certain people who were showing a talent for these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
In order to, it's actually quite difficult to work out exactly what he was doing it for, but certainly the end result was control of as many people as possible. Through the people who might genuinely be channeling, or might have ideas that they were channeling non-human entities,
mm-hmm.
put into their heads.
Well,
so it's actually a very, very potent way of getting at large numbers of people. If you say if you have somebody under your control, essentially, who then tells an awful lot of other people that they are in touch with the ancient gods,
it's very powerful. It's very powerful.
Well, telling me it's powerful, if you as a person believe that the ancient gods are giving you instructions or giving you advice, it would be foolish, really, to go against that.
Absolutely, and you couple that with the idea that, with technology that we have available to us today, people like Henry Kissinger, making comments, the name escapes me. I just flew out of my head. But he made an announcement, Bilderbergers, several years ago, about what would happen, how people of the world would basically beg, the governments to save them from an alien threat, whether it's real or promulgated. And I thought,
yes,
I thought that that was extremely telling, about where all this might come from.
I mean, it's a thought that other people have had as well, that, any threat, basically what it comes down to is when society is safe, the governments don't really have that much control.
Yeah, that's what they want you to believe.
They don't need it.
Yeah.
But when you get into a war situation or something, then you can start imposing things that people wouldn't accept at any other time.
Right.
Or, in a time of crisis.
Let me ask you this. What did you guys find any connection to the changing image of man and Tavistock? Tavistock is over there in your country. It's kind of a, I call it a sister organization of the CIA here, but I understand that Tavistock may have had some part to do with contracting SRI and Willis Harmon to prepare that document.
I honestly didn't know that, but I wouldn't be at all surprised. Yeah, the Tavistock clinic or Tavistock Institute,
right,
as it is here, would have worked very closely in that field. But the same things that SRI were doing, there was bound to be a crossover between them. Strange enough, Tavistock was something that when we actually wrote the Stargate conspiracy, we didn't know too much about then, but it's kind of crept into some of the things that we've worked on since.
Yeah, I've done some research on Tavistock and found out that it was initially funded by Rockefeller. Mm. They received a large amount of money in the 40s from the Rockefeller people here in the United States. I thought that was extremely interesting.
Mm. Many things are funded by the Rockefellers. A lot of these, even through to the research into alien abductions today.
I was just going to say that a lot of alleged alien abductees end up there, or maybe they start there. Who knows?
That's exactly right. We're going to take another break, and when we come back, we'll get some closing comments for the first hour, and I'd like to hold you guys over into the second hour if you've got the time. Will that be okay?
Yes, fine.
Yeah, this is a very interesting discussion. I think it's very important, too. So we'll take our break. When we come back, we'll get some more comments from you, and we're continuing our discussion on the book. The book is called The Stargate Conspiracy. I highly recommend everyone in the audience that you must get a copy of this because there's a lot more to come. And you must have this because it is a seminal work, I think, in connecting the dots about what has been going on the last 24, as they mentioned, 50 years. But at least from in my mind, with the research that I've done in the last 25 years, it's very, very important. So stay tuned. In about a minute, tell me real quick, you guys are working on a couple of other books and documentary projects. What are they?
We're researching the Knights Templar because we did write a book called The Templar Revelation, which is also on sale in the States. And we're looking more into the Second World War and the mysteries there and what the governments were really up to, what the royal family was really up to in the Second World War, which is interesting.
I suspect that you might find a connection even this. Is that going to be a possibility?
Strange enough, that's where we began to research the Tavistock thing because we were doing some work on the Second World War. It didn't come out of the Stargate thing at all. But to do with mind control there.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's it for the first hour. I want to thank you guys for joining us. And hang on, we'll take you on the second hour. Last hour, we were talking about the agents of the New Age conspiracy. We were talking a little bit about Tavistock mind control. Now, Stanford Research, SRI, which you've mentioned, has a very strong connection in all of this. What we know in the United States here from history and researching, Stanford Research, is that CIA has had a big part to play in funding that agency. Let's pick up there because I think it's interesting to note who some of the people were that were involved in SRI in the 80s before a lot of people knew who they even were.
The reason we focused in on SRI was because every avenue we were going down, every thread we were following, always seemed to lead to them. For example, when you go to start off with the Egypt thing, SRI have been over to Giza looking for hidden chambers. They've been doing it since the 1970s, and they were doing it right through the 80s. So SRI, they are doing things. A lot of people don't realize, but a lot of Richard Hoagland's Face on Mars stuff was the original funding for that came from SRI International.
Right.
SRI were the ones that did this report about New Age beliefs, Changing Images of Man report, some of a lot of the parapsychological research, the psychic warfare research that went on in the 70s and 80s. At SRI, which also comes into this picture. As you say, it's a very respected research institute. It has some top scientists there, but it's always been 75% upwards of its funding comes from the Department of Defense or the intelligence agencies like the CIA.
Yes, it's interesting that, as Clive said, the SRI was at the cutting edge of the early research, or fairly early research, mm-hmm. into what is now called remote viewing.
Right, exactly.
Which is the psychic warfare thing. And actually, we visited Uri Geller at his mansion a few years ago. And he showed us a videotape of an experiment that took place at SRI with him. And it was actually astonishing stuff. And curiously, by the way, he wasn't very good at metal bending, they thought, but he was good at everything else psychically there.
What about when you guys did your work on the SRI and the people that were connected to it? What did you see about the... for example, I know that Richard Hoagland's name came up at SRI, Whitley Strieber and people like that being connected to it. The reason I'm asking that is because I think in some of this whole thing, we're seeing a connection between some of the UFO myth that we have here in the United States, and I think you've got that as well in the UK, and some of the people that were involved in getting the paradigm shifted to the little gray aliens with the big black eyes.
Yes, I mean, that's something, I mean, it only really comes into the book towards the end, because that was another, we run out of pages for the book in the end, we just could have gone on and on with this, but
right.
We do start coming into the alien abduction thing, because that's part of it there, because, again, when you look into these things, you do find that there are connections between people that you wouldn't really expect. You know, you're looking at ancient Egypt, you're looking at Face on Mars, you're looking at alien abduction, you think that entirely different fields, but for example, the Face on Mars stuff. Willy Strieber, before he began writing his books about his abduction experiences, before he remembered his abduction experiences,
right,
was funding that work onto the Face on Mars, and he says it was actually seeing some of the computer enhanced. Images of the Face on Mars, these had actually triggered his memory of the alien abductions, which became the, which then caused him to write his book Communion, and introduced the whole notion of grey aliens. You know, that now becomes such a, you walk into any store and you're bound to see somewhere an alien-related image. So all these people are connected.
Mm-hmm.
There's a pattern there, and it is as if there's this system of belief being fed to us, being fed to the authors who write the books that are fed to us. I mean, we're not saying a lot of these authors that we mentioned are consciously part of this what we term the Stargate conspiracy, because the people behind it are very clever. They can feed ideas to people, knowing that they will write books, feed the idea on to us, leave it to us to join up those dots.
Who is James Hertak?
James Hertak, very interesting individual, and another name that comes in wherever you go with the threads followed in the Stargate conspiracy. You always end up with him.
Right.
He's probably best known as... he's kind of New Age prophet. He wrote a book called The Keys of Enoch back in the mid to late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
That's still in print and still around, which has a lot of these kind of New Age beliefs.
Right.
He was also working with or alongside SRI when they were doing their research in Giza in the 70s. He was actually the first person to talk about and promote the Face on Mars. He claimed to have actually been the first person to, in a way, discover...
He kind of paved the way for Hoagland, didn't he?
Sorry?
He kind of paved the way for Richard Hoagland.
He did, yes. I mean, he came in first. Hoagland came in later, a few years later. But, Hertak was doing the Face on Mars, and he was talking about the Sphinx and the pyramids. He's another one. He's still very involved in a lot of things to do with, Atlantis-type research. And he was also involved in something that we haven't mentioned yet, but is really the core of the conspiracy, this thing called the Council of Nine.
We're going to touch on that in the next break. We're going to take that break here, and when we come back, we'll enter the Nine, as you call them, the Council of Nine, because, like you said, they have a big part to play in all of this, and this is something we see even today in some of this literature that's coming out to get people to buy into the idea that there is an alien conspiracy behind all of this. Before we went to break, we were talking about the Council of Nine. What is the story about the Council of Nine? It's a big story, I'm sure.
It's a huge story, and it's ongoing. Basically, to cut a very long story short, the Council of Nine, they are non-human intelligences who allegedly come through various channelers.
Right.
And they've been doing this for over 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the channelers change, but they seem to have been, shall we say, to put it charitably, invited in by Andrei Puharich, the parapsychologist we talked about.
Right.
And among the channelers over the years was actually Yuri Geller. I mean, that's one of the first things he did when he became famous in the 70s.
Right.
But he rapidly went off them and made his excuses and left, basically. But James Hurtak, who we just mentioned, and Clive called him absolutely accurately as a New Age prophet, and we've heard him described as a messiah, or indeed the messiah,
right.
He actually is one of their main, the Council of Nine's channelers. Now, the thing is, the Council of Nine are unbelievably influential, mainly because they allegedly are the nine major gods of ancient Egypt. And their spokesman, who has the rather endearing name of Tom, is actually the great god Atum.
Ooh, okay.
Yes, it's really heavy stuff.
Uh-huh.
And as we were saying before, you know, if you really believe that you are being told some information or given some instruction from the great gods, I mean, you're going to obey. And the Nine are amazingly powerful through people like James Hurtak, who has an enormous following in America, in this country, and in Australia. But they also have other channelers. They also have written a couple of best-selling books, apart from the James Hurtak book. There's one called The Only Planet of Choice.
Mm-hmm.
Was channeled by Phyllis Schlemmer, an American psychic.
Right.
And is very, very big in the New Age and sort of those sort of circles. And Clive and I are not the only ones to be slightly worried by The Only Planet of Choice, because it states that the human race was seeded from the gods. And, you know, we part Syrians, you know, from Sirius.
Right.
Except for the indigenous race of Earth, the black people.
Hmm.
So, basically, it's saying, terribly nicely, of course, and not trying to incite anybody to anything nasty, but it's saying, you know, that everybody except the black people are part God, basically.
Well, see, you know, you might not be trying to incite anything nasty, but the question is, what are they trying to incite?
Exactly.
Exactly. Now, how does Andrei Puharich, as you mentioned before, he fits into all of this. Is he associated somehow with Hurtak?
Yes. It was Andrei Puharich who, just to give a little background, the Council of Nine first started coming through channelers in a research laboratory in Maine, a thing called the Round Table Foundation.
Right.
Back in the early 50s. Now, that was the guy in charge of that laboratory, which was looking into psychic and other matters. That was run by Andrei Puharich. That was in the 1950s.
Right.
In the 70s, Puharich began working with Yuri Geller, who also initially, as Lynn said, was in allegedly in psychic contact with the Council of Nine. And in the 70s, he formed another organization called Lab Nine, which was another kind of research institute, a bit looser and a bit more sort of a hippie commune than the 1950s version.
Right.
But this little organization, of which James Hurtak, who had been independently channeling the Nine since 1973, was essentially Puharich's second in command there, and was that the Council of Nine actually appointed Hertak as their spiritual leader, as they termed him, of this group. Both at the Round Table Foundation in the 1950s and Lab 9 in the 1970s were both very interesting organizations, but both very, very well connected. The Round Table Foundation was partly funded by a former vice president, vice president of the USA.
Which one?
That was Henry Wallace, who was the vice president to Roosevelt in Roosevelt.
He was also, wasn't he the guy that had something to do with the seal on the back of the dollar bill?
Yes, he's the one that that put that
the pyramid.
Triangle pattern.
Yeah.
He was the person responsible for getting that put on paper money back in the, well, I guess, can't remember off the top of my head, but 1930s, I think.
Right, yeah.
Which is taken, I mean, it's basically a Masonic sign. It certainly is now a Masonic symbol. But also was one that linked in with Edgar Cayce's prophecies of putting the capstone back on the Great Pyramid, because you'll all be more familiar with the United States seal than we are.
Right.
It's got that disembodied kind of...
The capstone is off the top. It's hovering above the pyramid.
That's right, yeah. And this was something that meant a lot to Henry Wallace, because he believed in this sort of prophecy that when the capstone was replaced on the pyramid, what he thought that symbol meant, his interpretation message on it, was when the capstone is returned, this will mark the time when, firstly, America is the dominant force in the world, and secondly, that Freemasonry would become the dominant force in the world. Henry Wallace was a very committed Freemason, so he obviously thought this was a good idea.
Now, did you mention that he helped fund Puharich and this group that Hertak was involved in?
That's right. He funded the Round Table Foundation.
I see. Okay, the Round Table.
Where Puharich ran in the 50s, which is where the Nine first appeared. And then it goes through to, in the 1970s, there was equally sort of, high-level backers there. There were people that were personal friends of President Ford, as it was then, who were turning up at Lab 9 in the 1970s. Gene Roddenberry, who wrote Star Trek, was part of Lab 9 for a while. I mean, that's an interesting one for people.
Yes, especially when you consider Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, I wondered that, and I know that you mentioned this in the book. I wondered about the whole inference in Star Trek to the Nine. I've heard these rumors about Gene Roddenberry and some of the stuff that he was involved in. Who is Arthur M. Young? I noted that you mentioned him in the book. He was one of the early guys that was involved in some of this stuff. The thing is that these names are well-connected, like you said. They're well-connected people at the very top of the political and financial food chain, if you will. And it seems like they're really, in the early 50s, in the early days, they were all trying to get this stuff ramped up.
That's right. You've got this Round Table Foundation, which was established in the late 40s, but the Nine first appeared there in the 1950s. You've got Henry Wallace, former vice president, funding it. Arthur Young, he was really the person behind the Bell helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
He invented the Bell helicopter, so he's the man behind the Bell Helicopter Corporation. So obviously, he had money as a result of his work there.
Yeah.
Now, he was kind of the second in command at the Round Table Foundation under Puharich. They kind of ran this thing together.
Yeah.
After his work on the Bell helicopter, he became interested in spiritual matters. What we would now term New Age beliefs, things like theosophy and so on.
Yeah.
Which is why he got involved in this foundation. But the other thing, when we come to the Round Table Foundation, that's less well known, because is as Lynn and I looked into it, we found actually, yes, it was getting funding from Henry Wallace. Yes, it was involving all these other people. One of the Astor family was also involved in it right at the beginning. That what wasn't known at the time, but is known now, that a lot of the money to fund that work actually came from the Defense Department.
Yeah.
Because they were doing research into the military uses of parapsychology.
Exactly.
Psychic things.
Mm-hmm.
And now that changed the picture. When we knew that the Council of Nine first appeared in this place that was being funded by the Defense Department.
Yeah. Turning on my guests in the United Kingdom at an ungodly hour over there are Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. I want to again thank you for being on the program tonight talking about your book, The Stargate Conspiracy. Before we went to break, we were talking about some of these, the Defense Department having some hand in this. Lynn, you were going to throw something in. Go ahead.
Yes, we were talking about Andre Puharit, who was being funded by the Defense Department in parapsychological research and experiments. And one of the things that is, well, a couple of things very interesting about him personally is that he was a trained master hypnotist, qualified master hypnotist.
Right.
But also he invented medical devices such as hearing aids. And one of the things that he was particularly proud of was he invented a tooth radio, a little device you could put in your mouth and hear things. And of course, if you put all this together, and there is indeed some evidence that he basically made people hear voices in their heads, and the voices were very real voices.
Right, yes. Mm-hmm.
He was perhaps, literally beaming, almost certainly, in fact, literally beaming voices into their heads.
See, it makes you...
The voices just happened to be the Council of Nine's voices, so much the better.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, what's really going on here? I mean, it starts to take on, as you said, a kind of a dark overtone, shades of deception and intrigue, Now,
it's also the way you can put the story together, the way it's usually told in most books.
Yes.
Gary Hodge at the Round Table Foundation in the 1950s got into contact with some entities called the Council of Nine that claimed to be the major nine gods of ancient Egypt, and that this continued through the 60s, through the 70s, through the 80s, with different channelers. And, you can look at it and you think, maybe something's going on here. Maybe they really are in touch with the ancient gods of Egypt. Why not? So you can tell the story that way, but then you look at what else Biharich was doing at the same time, and literally at the same time that he was doing this first work with the Council of Nine in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
He's working at the Round Table Foundation, but he's at that time, because he was in the U.S. Army, a major, I believe, that he'd been invalided out.
Right.
They called him back in, and why they called him back in at that time was to work at the U.S. Army Chemical Weapons Center in Maryland, which obviously is something to do with the chemical warfare.
Right. Okay.
But that is also the place where the mind control experiments were being done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Puharich went in there for. That was his speciality. And he worked on the MKUltra project, which was a CIA mind control project, but on some aspects of it, the CIA and the U.S. Army worked together.
Right.
And the projects that Puharich was working on at the Chemical Weapons Center were part of MKUltra project, mind control project, and he's doing this at the same time that he's also working with these channelers who are getting in touch with ancient Egyptian gods, and you begin to wonder if there's a tie-up between these two.
And the thing is, Puharich always began when he had a new promising psychic talent. He always began by hypnotizing them.
Yeah, and I was going to mention that too, because there was another disturbing part of Puharich's work, not only with the hypnosis and the fact that you mentioned in here that he seemed to always start off by hypnotizing his psychics, but he also had the space kids, or Geller kids, as he called them. And so they were bringing children who were talented into a project and perhaps maybe messing with their minds.
Oh, well, certainly. I mean, there's no two ways about it. It just had to be. But I just want to return to something. In case people are sitting out there and thinking, well, it's just Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince's opinion. I mean, maybe, the Council of Nine really are the ancient gods of Egypt. Well, if they are, they've forgotten any Egyptian they once knew.
Mm-hmm.
Because you often hear from people like Richard Hoagland about that, you know, a couple of words, ancient Egyptian words, Arkur, mean shining, beginning, ending.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, all the Sphinx. And in fact, Arkur means silver. In fact, but interestingly enough, the interpretation that Richard Hoagland and other people come out with that I've just mentioned comes from the Council of Nine. And where did they get it from, if it's wrong? From a misreading of Wallace Budge's Dictionary of Hieroglyphics.
Yeah, see, there's flaws in this, isn't there?
Yeah.
Big flaws, I should say, too, because they're glaring.
Mm.
Yeah, because as I say, when you first start looking at this story and putting it together, you begin to think, hey, yeah, maybe the gods are coming back. But when you start to dig a bit deeper and you think, well, no, because they wouldn't make mistakes like this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, the process that Lynn and I went through. We were led to look at the Council of Nine. We soon realized that the Council of Nine is very different to the other, you know, there are lots of channeling cults around today. Lots of people are going to channel aliens or Atlanteans or whatever. But we realized this one was different. This one, it's been around for half a century, and it's either involved or has influenced some very important people, or it's influenced, at least had the ear of. But you begin to wonder, you know, are the gods back? But then we say, no, they can't be, because they actually do make mistakes in their history
mm-hmm.
and get their words wrong. And then when you get to the fact that everywhere you look in the history of the Nine, there is a connection with the intelligence agencies.
Absolutely.
There.
Yeah.
And it's as if they've been pushing this whole thing. Then you get to the question of why. Why should the intelligence agencies want to you know, create, promote, push along this idea that people are in touch with the gods of ancient Egypt?
Let's turn our attention to that. Why would they? What do you think that the goal is? What is the goal?
Well, what the goal is in all intelligence operations like this, and certainly long-term ones, is, well, first of all, a kind of experiment to see how people's minds work, which is always very useful. But ultimately, the goal has to be control.
Right.
You know, control of the masses, and the more the merrier. I mean, the thing is that underlying the Council of Nine material is a very, very worrying, I mean, touched on it earlier, but very worrying right-wing bias,
uh-huh.
almost a fundamentalist bias.
Uh-huh.
Basically, people who are right-wing are much more easy to control than people who are liberal and sit on the fence.
Right, sure. But the thing is are they, you know, in other words, there's a lot of talk about the New World Order.
Mm.
I mean, how much stock do you put into that?
We certainly don't buy into a lot of the classic New World Order conspiracy ideas. But on the other hand, we obviously do believe that there are conspiracies aimed at manipulating the population in certain directions.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think, and I hope we're right not to think, that it will actually go to the point of, you know, that there will be a conspiracy to enslave everybody in the world. Don't think it will be like that. But I think maybe we're wrong. But this particular thing that we're talking about, the Stargate conspiracy, as we chose to call it, the way we looked at it was the traditional religions have certainly lost a lot of their power,
right.
A lot of their influence, a lot of their control over the daily lives of people. And people are moving towards these kind of New Age beliefs, ones that involve, you know, extraterrestrial intelligences, Atlantis, this kind of thing. And it's almost like someone's constructing, which is what we believe is happening, that somebody's consciously constructing a new religion for the new millennium.
Absolutely.
All these things that people have invested all this belief in. They create a new religion, which in the end will be kind of like the old religions, really.
Mm-hmm.
They're about control, too, when you When you come down to it.
Well, I mean, the thing that bothers me is that the last lot of people to hijack the Atlantis myth were, of course, the Nazis. And, you know, as Clive said, and people certainly in Britain these days are not at all interested in the sort of organised and established religions and churches. But there is, a huge underground swell of the New Age. I mean, we don't know how many people are involved, but there are enormous numbers of people involved, and a lot of them are quite well-heeled, sort of upper-middle-class people, some titled people who are involved, things like that. And basically, you know, if you can dress up what is basically a form of, I mean, I'm sticking my neck out here, but maybe a form of extreme right-wing belief, but you dress it up as the gods giving you this instruction or this belief. And it's your mindset, and you want desperately to believe that you're somehow in touch with this romantic, with the gods coming back, which makes sense of everybody's lives and especially your own, then of course you're going to go along with the most outrageous ideas. It's like a spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down.
Yes, exactly. Welcome back, Lynn Ticknett and Clive Prince, authors of The Stargate Conspiracy. And before the last break ended, we were talking about the implications. Let's talk a little bit more about the further implications of where this conspiracy could go.
Straight answer is, Matthew, we don't know. We don't know what this is part of, if it's part of something even bigger. The conspiracy that we're talking about, which is this one to create and promote this belief system, it didn't finish with the millennium. It's carrying on. It's kind of continued to promote itself and to gain followers. Whether it's tied into other kind of similar campaigns in other spheres, we just don't know. Worrying thought that it is, but even as it is by itself. An aspect of this we haven't touched on, we're talking about this as a kind of an attempt to create a mass movement.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the other thing that cults can do is, it's not necessarily how thousands of members, but if you can get the ear of the right people. And this is something that the Council of Nine certainly have done. As I said, right from the beginning, there was a vice president involved. There's certainly connections between individuals connected with the Council of Nine and Al Gore. Al Gore was actually, who is quite open to, vaguely New Age ideas.
Right, sure.
Certainly environmental things. And by all accounts, he was actually quite open to what Council of Nine are saying. Not saying he took that all on board, but he was open to it.
Right.
That opens up a very interesting scenario, doesn't it, if he'd have got in.
Yeah. As the president of the United States, sure.
A handful of votes, in Florida. And, there could be a president who the Council of Nine have the ear of. Things like that begin to get worrying. When your political leaders or your business leaders you believe that they're talking to the gods. There's an absolute nightmare scenario there. There's a lot that's very scary about all this, but the important thing is to get it out in the open, to get it talked about. All these kind of conspiracies work on the basis that you're only getting to hear half the story.
Yes,
and also, apart from politicians and people like Gene Roddenberry and Uri Geller, there have been, a huge swathe of cutting-edge scientists, physicists, who are determined to, get any shred of help in their search to be the first with some new breakthrough in science, that they will actually even listen to the Council of Nine. And the Council of Nine actually have had some devotees from the highest echelons of the scientific community, and probably still do. Now, that's very interesting. We're not saying that anybody involved directly with sort of the Mars mission was involved in this, but it's an interesting thought.
Yes, it is. You have to question all of this. This kind of leads to an idea that, people cannot any longer, they must not just sit back and accept everything as rote. They need to go out and they need to ask hard questions of their leaders and people who have you know, in my opinion, people that have some of these ideas, they need to ask them the hard questions.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, exactly the way Lynn and I feel, that, you know, the important thing is think for yourself. You know, just don't accept things. You know, we started the research for this book by, you know, we were reading other books and getting very excited about what we read, but thinking, hey, let's just check a couple of these things. Let's just not, because it's in a book, accept it.
Right.
Let's go and double check some of these facts.
And look what you found.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Yes, it hijacked the book we were going to write, and so we wrote this one instead.
Yeah. It took in a completely different direction to where we thought we were going.
I'm just curious, with all the millennium buildup that there was in 99, did you folks go to the celebration in Egypt that they held on January 1 of 2000?
No.
Did you hear anything of
Egypt then?
No, we were in Scotland, you know, because that's the only place to celebrate New Year of any time.
Yeah. Did you hear anything as far as, you know, because they did have a big millennium celebration. And I know that the pyramid was closed down to visitors for, what, a year before that happened?
Yes.
It's open again now. But.
Allegedly for refurbishment, which actually does make you wonder, doesn't it, what they're up to?
Yeah, I mean, did you hear anything about what might have really happened in there, or what?
No, it was reopened. They were, you know, supposedly cleaning it and fitting new ventilation and this and that. It was closed. It reopened. But sometimes, you know, you begin to think that the whole area that it was being closed was to make people ask why it's closed, you know, leading up to the millennium.
Kind of focusing everybody's attention there.
That's this. The psychology behind a lot of the things we're talking about is very clever. You know, it's if you can't actually find the Hall of Records underneath the Sphinx, the next best thing you can do is start the rumor that somebody has found it, but it's being covered up.
Yeah, sure.
There's plenty of people believe that.
Right.
You know, so close the door and people want to know what's behind it.
Uh-huh.
Now, often the answer is there's nothing behind it, but you're really interested to know what's behind, aren't you? So a lot of these things are, you know, maybe closing the pyramid was just for the sake of people thinking there's something suspicious going on there.
You know? And there are also wild rumors, and sometimes more than rumors, an alleged video showing, you know, people in an underground lake and Giza, or there were rumors about people having discovered the tomb of Osiris. I mean, Osiris is a god, you know. And, of course, none of this proved to have any foundation.
Right.
But it just served to whip up more interest.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, since that time has passed, and you're continuing research, where do you think, as far as this whole thing reaching a critical mass, is it reaching a critical mass, or is some of it starting to subside a little bit?
It's a hard one to judge, because we're still only, you know, a couple of years on from the millennium. Yes, I mean, things did subside afterwards, but it's beginning to build up again now.
Mm-hmm.
But, September the 11th has changed things as well. That was something no one was expecting. That,
right.
That's kind of, you know, thrown everything into confusion. So you don't know which way is going now. I mean, it might make people go more into these kind of quasi-spiritual things. It might take them away from it. Of course, the next the date that the Council of Nine actually kept pinpointing in their material was actually 2003. They never actually said precisely what's going to happen then, but that's the one that they always talked about, not 2003. And of course, there are prophecies to do with 2012 as the next big date.
Yes, but in classic cult fashion, you know, when 2003 comes and nothing happens, it'll be, oh, we meant really 2012.
They seem to be doing that a lot, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we're
lots of cults. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, lots of cults that are based on, you know, prophecies, I mean, have that as a recurring phenomenon.
Yes.
You know, you're told to, you know, sit up a tree and wait for the aliens to come in their spaceships and carry you off, and, you know, not to wear any sort of gold or something, and, you know, and give all your money away beforehand. And you sit on the top of the tree, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you just get cold. And you come out of the tree and realize you've given everything away.
Exactly.
And you look really foolish, and they're never coming. Yeah. But then the channeler says to you, ah, but that was a test of your faith.
Yeah.
And they're coming, you know, in 5 years' time.
Yeah. Well... We only have about a minute and a half left. I want to thank you folks for being on the program tonight. It's been a very interesting interview. And we were talking here about, you've got another book coming out, Double Standards, and the Templar Revelation is another piece of work that you're doing. I want you to keep me posted as to what's going on. We can have you back as guests, okay?
We'd love to. Yeah.
Absolutely love to, yeah. Yeah. Enjoyed tonight very much.
Yeah, I did too. Give out your website real quick where you have some of the material on the Stargate Assembly.
Right. The address is www.pharo, that's spelled pharo.com. So www.pharo.com. There's Stargate Assembly, which you can get in touch with us through it. So we're actually redesigning at the moment, so if nothing happens for a couple of weeks, please bear with us.
Okay. Well, listen, again, thank you very much, and I want to thank you for your hard work and what it's taken to get that kind of information out to the public. It's been good, and you're to be commended for it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
It's been excellent.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's it for us tonight. Thank you for joining us.